Are we expecting everybody here? Oh, good. Okay, good. Good morning.
Sorry, Corey, I couldn't return your call yesterday.
That's all right, I'll catch you later.
Hello. We have to stop hanging out, but you must be tired. Congratulations, great event.
Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Council. Before we begin the official part of the council, each week I ask a question of the community is, how are the children? The reason that I ask that is that when our children are well, the community is well. And each week I invite experts in to talk to us about children and youth. This morning we've got some students from Emerson School, which is one of the schools in downtown Portland, and they're third graders. And they've been learning about different aspects of Portland with these classes. And today they're here to share with us a special project they've been working on. They've done surveys, written poems, and spoken with their classmates in order to portray what is most important to kids in our city and where the most kid-friendly places are here in Portland. So I'm very pleased that they're willing to come down to council and share their information with us. So could we please welcome Michaela Capaggi, Eamon Connor, and Berkeley Franklin. Well, thank you for being here. So I don't know which of you is to speak first, but anybody can. And when you speak, just let us know your first name. You can pull those microphones down so you don't have to stand up. There you go.
Hello, Mr. Mayor and City Council. I am Berkeley Franklin, a third grader at the Emerson School. This poem is supposed to be a warning about future buildings. I hope you take it well. This poem was written because I heard about a building being built that was very tall, but people decided to tear it back down because they didn't like it. Then built it back up and tore it back down again and kept doing that until it finally suited them. It made me feel like resources were being wasted. That made me feel like everybody's hard work and the use of those resources was for nothing. Here's the poem. The building was an idea at first, but when it was built, it was a dream come true to most people. But to some people, it was a mistake. It was a tall building, true. It attracted people, true, but they changed their minds. So they wasted material and fuel and time and energy to bring it down. Up and down, down and up. But when they were finished, they were happy. Finally. The moral is fuel, time, energy, and material can be wasted all because of people who wanted something not one of them had seen.
Very good.
I am Michaela. I live in the Sullivan's Gulch. It is over the Broadway Bridge between I-84 and Broadway. Every week on Sunday, we have a party called Soup Night, where a host makes soup or barbecue, and then the people that come bring a side dish to share. Also, we have a bunch of fun parties like Mulch in the Gulch, Gulcharama, and the Big Garage Sale. I think it is a good way to meet your neighbors. I go to the Emerson School downtown. One thing that is different is that it is not in a school zone, and the park is built for everybody, not just for the school. I wish we could go down to the courts more because it is a lot of fun. So you can have a soccer game, two soccer games, and a basketball game going at the same time. I think what would make the school a little bit more successful is if we had homework, which would challenge you after school as well as in school.
Thank you.
Wow, that's great.
Okay, I don't know what to say. Oh, God.
I feel like that about twice a day, so don't feel bad.
That's okay. Why don't you just tell us your first name?
My name's Eamon, and I'd like to tell you about some things we do in our school. We have a project to get kids from other states of the country to Portland to...
You're doing great.
By it. Oh my God.
So you bring people from other parts of the country?
We study places from all of our class goes places and studies them and sees why it's kid friendly.
Yeah. What's one of the places you've gone to?
What? Portlandia.
Oh, Portlandia.
Oh, yeah.
Just right across the street.
What'd you think of Portlandia?
It was big.
A lot of people say that.
Yeah.
Did you know that Portlandia is the second largest copper statue in the United States? Do you know which one is the first in big size?
Statue of Liberty, I think.
Good wow. Answer.
Very good.
Wow.
Nice.
I want to thank you guys for being here this morning.
I may have missed it, but can I ask how old you three are again?
I am 9.
I'm 8.
And I'm 8.
Good job. Wow. Excellent job. Thank you very much. Let's give these folks a hand. You know, you guys don't have to stay for the rest of it. It's not going to be nearly as interesting as what you said. City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Potter?
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity they are authorized to represent. Please read the first communication.
Item 1425, request of Carol Sima to address council regarding Montevilla in action. She indicated she will have to reschedule.
Please read the next.
1426, request of Fritz Hirsch to address council regarding Montevilla in action. He too will be rescheduling.
Okay, please read the next.
1427, request of Patricia A. Trice to address council regarding family rights, including rights of grandparents, raising grandchildren, and adoption.
Please come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. When you speak, please have a seat.
Mayor, I'd like to request part of my time be given to Carolyn Smith, if it's permissible.
Only one person can speak in a 3-minute segment. Thank you. And please state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
My name is Patricia Trice, and I've been married for 38 years, the mother of 3 biological children, 1 adopted child, and 9 grandchildren, of which 1 is deceased, ranging from the age of 3 years old to 15 years old. I've had the awesome opportunity to help care for and raise my grandchildren as an aid and a help to my children. I am an active member and evangelist missionary of Cornerstone Community Church, teaching young children from 3 through 19 years of age. I have been a past brownie leader, bluebird leader, and a campfire girl leader. I've taught youth arts and crafts at King Elementary School, served on several PTAs and PTSAs and school site councils throughout my children's schooling. I've done countless hours of volunteer hours in nursing homes and children's hospitals. I have a heart, a mind, and a conviction, and a very strong compassion for our children, and not just mine, but all children. I am an active member of True Dialogue Mentoring and Counseling Agency. I am also an active member and board member of Grandparents Raising Grandchildren and a community activist. It is a fact more than 6 million children, approximately 1 in 12, are living in households headed by grandparents. which is 4.5 million children, or either other relatives, which is 1.5 million children. In many of these homes, grandparents, which are approximately 2.4 million, or 34%, are taking on the primary responsibility for the children's needs. Often they assume this responsibility without the parents being present in the home. 29% of these grandparents are African American, 17% are Hispanic Latino, 2% American Indian or Alaska Native, and 47% white. 71% of these grandparents are under the age of 60, and 19% live in poverty. In Oregon, the state of Oregon, there are 37,535 children living in grandparent head household. That's 4.4% of all the children in the state of Oregon. 22,103 grandparents report that they are responsible for their grandchildren living with them. In Portland alone, there is 3,122 grandparents reporting that the grandchildren live with them. However, many grandparents who are, in fact, raising their grandchildren do so informally without legal rights or recognition because they fear revealing this information to federal agencies or even state agencies. Why? Because across the United States, families are losing custody of their children. Or I should reverse it around and say that children are losing their families at an alarming rate. Instead of helping grandparents with housing needs, child care, or special medical needs, or even giving training, or in some cases abuse, DHS, Department of Human Resources, is not doing what it should according to its own policies and procedures. Many state agencies have guidelines that
ma'am,
they take.
Do you, you know how much longer you have because you run over? I'll give you another minute, but you'll have
I'm,
to run
I am here on behalf of Carolyn Smith fighting to stop the adoption of her two grandchildren, Kofi Owings and C. Lynn Black, for October 30th because of procedures and policies that were not followed by DHS. She was not given the opportunity or the right according to procedures and policies of DHS to legally become an adoptive parent. She applied for adoption. She was denied. She went through all the loopholes of doing everything that DHS asked her to do to qualify to adopt. Individual state home investigation was done by a Christian adoption agency that qualified her as a suitable parent, grandparent, to raise her two children that she's fighting to get. DHS is bound on adopting them outside of the family. She fights to keep her children with her family, to keep that bond and the family ties together. She has five other siblings belonging to the two that she's trying to adopt.
May I ask just one question?
Yes.
Clarify, ma'am. I have a question that has two parts. The first is, what authority do we as a council have in a DHS proceeding?
Second, what action are you asking us to take?
I am asking Mayor Tom Potter and all of you as commissioners to help us put a halt to the adoption for October 30th, that a full investigation of the procedures and the policies of DHS, that they have followed every policy, every procedure according to adoption outside of Mrs. Carolyn Smith's family.
I used to deal with these issues a lot in the legislature, and I would strongly urge that you contact your state representative and state senator. They are your direct representatives in Salem and deal directly with DHS. And they would be, and I'm assuming you're from Portland.
We are from Portland,
so
yes.
So I would suggest that that be the recommendation.
Do you know who your state senator or state?
Yes, and we have went to the Capitol. We have lobbied and rallied and talked to them. We are now in the process of requesting an audience with them. She has just found out that DHS is trying to make this adoption final on October 30th, which is why we are here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Please call the next.
Item 1428, request of Midge Purcell to address council regarding family rights, including rights of grandparents, raising grandchildren, and adoption policies.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Mitch Purcell.
3 minutes.
My name is Mitch Purcell. I'm with the Urban League of Portland. Good morning to the mayor and to this council. I'm here to speak in support of Carolyn Smith, who is fighting to keep her family together and stop the adoption of her two grandchildren. Ms. Smith is a member of our Urban League's grandparent support group. I know that it is not in the gift of this council and the mayor to reverse a decision made by another state agency, but I'm asking this body to use its good offices to question the practices in any authority that undermines viable families and have poor outcomes for children and families of color. Ms. Smith is not atypical. She is one of the growing number of grandparents raising her grandchildren for a whole range of reasons, like divorce, teenage pregnancy, substance abuse, and incarceration. And Ms. Smith did everything right. She stepped up to the plate and is raising her 5 grandchildren. And she did what our families have done for centuries. It is our culture and it is our way to find a way. Even if we're poor, even if we're short on space, even if we're over 50, she stepped up to the plate, and I think that she should be commended for that. When her two youngest were taken into care, she petitioned to adopt them, and every obstacle was placed in the way, in spite of policies that are supposed to give families priority when determining custody. Oregon has an adoption policy that prohibits race or culture as being a factor for fostering an adoption, and it's all for the right reasons. But the result is that the practice of colorblind adoption has meant losing sight of the cultural and heritage needs of children of color, and often the need to be connected to the community and be connected to their families. The Urban League would like to see a review of adoption and fostering policies and practice that would result in more culturally and racially sensitive placements for kids of color. Children certainly should not languish in care, but every effort should be made to, number one, keep families together, and number two, ensure that grandparents and biological family members are enabled to retain these children by additional resources, by housing needs and services. And every effort should be made to place children in families that reflect their cultural and racial heritage so they can be adequately prepared for what the challenges that they'll face in a racially and discriminatory society. So I urge the City Council as individuals to support attempt to stay the adoption. There's a hearing on October 30th. We're asking people to write to Judge Nan Waller to consider staying the adoption while the case is further reviewed. So thank you for your time.
I had a question for you. Have you, as the Urban League, tried to contact either the state senator or state representative?
We have, and including the governor's office. So
what's been the response?
I think there is an acknowledgement that the practices of DHS needs to be reviewed, and I think we've had a positive response from DHS as well to say that these practices need to be reviewed. It's very difficult at this stage to, as I said, reverse what's happened, although we will attempt on October 31st to open this for review, for further review. But we're particularly concerned about the policy issues that led to this outcome, and really strongly urging review so other families don't face similar circumstances.
Well, thank you very much for coming. We're going to move to the consent agenda. Between last week and now, we've had three items pulled from the consent agenda, items 14, 30, 38, and 39. If it's okay with the council, I'd like to hear them after the 9:30 time certain. Any problems? Okay. Please read the 9:30. Let's call a vote on the consent agenda.
Did you ask the audience for pulls?
Yes. Does anybody in this room wish to pull any item from the consent agenda? Any commissioners wish to pull any other items?
There's a fellow over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm not hearing very well. 1430, I'd like to comment on.
Yes, it's being pulled. Please call the vote.
Adams.
Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please read the 9:30 time certain.
Item 1429, approve the 30-year tax exemption requested by the Shaver Green Limited Partnership for the Shaver Green Rental Housing Project.
Hi, I'm Barbara Sack from the Planning Bureau, and I'm here to present the Planning Commission's recommendation on a tax exemption request by Shaver Green Limited Partnership, represented by Wayne Armstrong, who's here today, and Roland Stafford. They request a 30-year tax exemption under the city's TOD program for the proposed Shaver Green rental project. The TOD program is one of the city's two multifamily programs and is available in areas outside the central city where the city has planned for transit-oriented development. This project is located in one of those areas. It's located on the west side of MLK Boulevard, just north of Shaver. The project is a six-story building. It has 85 rental units, a combination of one- and two-bedroom apartments and one three-bedroom apartment. There's no ground floor commercial use in this building. Four units in this project will be affordable to very low-income households at 30% median family income, and the remainder will be affordable to low-income households at 60% median income. And there will be one manager's unit. All the units are affordable to low-income households and will be covered by affordability agreements with the State of Oregon and the Portland Development Commission. The length of the State of Oregon's agreement is 30 years, and PDC's is 60 years. This project will also provide 10 permanently supportive housing units with services provided by LifeWorks Northwest, and these will be reserved for developmentally disabled individuals. This project will provide three public benefits from the public benefit option list in the TOD regulations. They are net density that is at least 80% of the maximum density allowed by the RH zone. The project will pursue LEED Silver certification from the U.S. Green Building Council, and they have over twice the percentage of affordable units required by the TOD affordability requirement. As you might remember, back in 2006, when Council made a number of changes to the TOD program, you approved a change that would allow a longer than 10-year tax exemption for low-income housing projects subject to a low-income housing assistance contract to provide low-income housing. And these contracts are the State of Oregon Affordability Agreement and PDC Affordability Agreement. Both these entities have provided public financing for this project. PDC reviewed this application back in August of this year, and they found that the tax exemption was necessary to the financial feasibility of the project. They found that the internal rate of return for the first 30 years would be about 4.58%, which is well below the 10% internal rate of return allowed by the code. Without the exemption, the internal rate of return would be minus 2.68%. Their loan committee approved recommending approval of this tax exemption request to Planning Commission. Planning Commission held a hearing on this request on September 23rd, and they recommended approval, provided that the project provided the three public benefits listed in the application. So the Planning Commission recommends to City Council that they approve this tax exemption request for 30 years with the condition that the three public benefits be provided. This project will provide needed affordable housing in an area of the city that's experiencing gentrification and also can provide housing for people employed at nearby workplaces such as Emanuel Hospital and the Lloyd District businesses. One final thing, as you know, there's a $20 million cap on the improvement value of new TOD projects that come before council in a tax year. This is the only project. This project applied for the TOD in May 2008, and they were the only project applying for the TOD tax exemption in that tax year. They're the only new project that applied. The value of this project is going to be about $17 million, so it's under the $20 million cap. So Wayne Armstrong is here from the project, and Dan Williams is here from the Portland Development Commission. So if you have any questions.
Would it be helpful to my colleagues to put this in the context of the discussion we've had prior to this about the TOD program and the abatements?
That'd be great.
First of all, at execs today, you're going to get two documents in advance of being put on the calendar for next week. One is the report prepared by PDC and the Bureau of Planning and reviewed by my office, which is a response to the audit that was done of the whole abatement program. And Commissioner Leonard, the report will specifically zero in on the new measures that are being taken to ensure that occupants of units that are abated qualify under the program, and new methods for monitoring compliance. So that's a big piece of the response to the audit and concerns raised by the council. The second document that we're going to distribute is a document that PDC and the Bureau of Planning in my office have been working on, which is the first annual report on tax abatements, which gives you a 30,000-foot level of all abatements under all five categories, and includes things like the foregone revenue to all jurisdictions, the actions taken within the year, compliance actions that were taken, for example, highlighting units that were taken out of abatement programs because it was determined they were no longer in compliance and the like. So we'll have a chance next week to brief the council on the steps we've taken to really improve these programs. The question that many of you may be asking is, we had a similar kind of proposal come before council a couple months ago where we were struggling with an extension of a TOD abatement program. And there's a couple of key distinctions I just want to raise so that you're comfortable that we're not setting a precedent that's inconsistent. If you recall, a prior project that came before us involved units, many of units that were in excess of 60% of MFI. This council has been pretty clear that the affordability component is 60 and below, and that when you start creeping up to 80%, that while that may be the definition of other governmental jurisdictions, it's not our definition of affordability. So that's a key distinction. Number two, this is not an example of someone who came before, that put together a project with a pro forma that assumed a 10-year TOD abatement and then financial viability beyond that. This is an example of a developer at the front end of the process coming and saying, I'm prepared to maintain affordability for 60 years and provide an amenity. And so it's different. And in terms of just analyzing this, if the developer in this case was a nonprofit developer, they would get the abatement. What this council has done is said that for-profit developers, under certain circumstances, would also be eligible for an extension of the 10-year TOD. And that's where there are binding regulatory agreements that maintain affordability for the whole 30-year term. Under those circumstances, a for-profit and nonprofit developer become indistinguishable from our point of view because we're getting affordable units and we have regulatory agreements in place which ensure that those units remain affordable. So from my point of view after studying this, I believe that in granting this, we will be acting consistent with prior council actions. And in addition, we will not be setting a precedent that will get us sort of in front of ourselves in terms of the discussion we're going to be having at the broader level about abatement policy. It was my view that we should postpone the broader discussion on abatements till next week so that we don't conflate these issues. And I want to have a chance to have council ask robust questions about our abatement policies, what's working, what isn't, and what steps have been taken to tighten the bolts. But on this one, just to summarize, this is a request being made at the outset of the project. It's consistent with the council's view that a TOD abatement, 10-year abatement, can be extended if affordability is mandated by regulatory agreements for the full term. And it meets our definition of affordability, which is 60% and below. In fact, a number of the units are 30% and below. And as Barbara has noted, there are also additional units here that are permanent supportive housing units, which where they're partnering with LifeWorks Northwest, which meets our 10-year plan to end homelessness goals. So hopefully that's context which puts this in the which distinguishes this application from one we dealt with a couple months ago.
I really appreciate that explanation, Commissioner Fish, and I would go so far as to say it's the best synopsis of our program that I've heard here yet. It's very helpful. In 2003, the council adopted a resolution that said that abatements when granted must then by the grantee cause a financial statement to be filed with the city every year. And the reason for that is that based on everybody's best work in applying for an abatement, as in this case, where you take into account what you anticipate to be the costs and the rents, they can be wrong. And the best way to look at whether or not the financial projection is wrong or not is to actually look at a financial statement each year to see, in fact, how the project performs. I didn't see that in here as part of the conditions of approval that they will submit an annual financial statement. Is that not here because you just...
It's in the code.
That's what I was going to ask.
It's part of the regulation, so... If you remember, there was before it got into the code, we used to make that a condition, you know, when requested. But since
before that got in the code, that was not something that was done. I spent a lot of work on that, and there were not financial statements being given. If there were, the people that I asked at the time did not know about it at PDC that were supposed to be monitoring this.
I think Barbara's point was it may have been in a contractual agreement, but as Randy pointed out, more honored in the breach than the observance.
Right.
Yeah. It's now in the code, so it doesn't have to be listed as a condition.
So just so I'm at ease and I understand better, it's such an accepted policy now that you somewhere put it in a document for the...
It's in the TOD regulations. It's one of the regulations that govern the program.
I understand that, but does the applier for the tax abatement know that up front, or do you assume that the person applying reads the code?
I'd have to ask PDC.
Could you come forward?
I'm just curious why you wouldn't have it in the document.
We can't have you talk from the seats.
I'm just curious why. I understand it's in the code, but why wouldn't you have it in the document so they when they sign it, they've understood by signing it that they're required to submit that?
Please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Wayne Armstrong. I'm the developer, along with my wife, Roland Stauffer, of the Shaker property.
Hi, good morning. I'm Dan Williams. I'm an underwriter with PDC. And in answer to your question, we have PDC financing on the project already, a separate 40-year loan, so they're going to be reporting annually on that. That's already in our loan documents. There'll also be a separate regulatory...
What are they reporting? What is it that you're getting in a report? What is that?
It's monitoring the rent levels to make sure they're meeting the affordability requirements, and then we're monitoring the cash flow and calculation of payments on the loan.
But specifically, what the section of the code requires that I'm talking about, that the financial conditions that were submitted that caused the abatement to happen remain throughout the term of the abatement or the abatement goes away. That's specifically what the code says. How do you monitor for that?
I think that will be covered in the regulatory agreement for the abatement.
Within the TOD agreement. Yeah. There is specific things.
And I'm just asking who monitors that.
That would be the asset management department at PDC.
It was under my impression that PDC would be the recipient of the annual reports that would be going to the state regarding the correct enforcement of the people that are moving into this building, along with the financial, as you said, the analysis that's giving every year. That's part of the package that's given to the state and is also required.
Has it been made clear to you that if you do better financially on the project than what you anticipated, and better beyond what the rate of return that you projected, that you could lose the abatement?
That's correct.
That was made clear to you?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and our perform at this point, as Dan or Barbara mentioned, it's within the 4% range. So we do have some ability to move up, but we have a long way to go before we get to that threshold.
This is helpful for me, Commissioner Leonard, and as part of our presentation next week, we'll actually pull the regulatory agreement, the code, and the contracts, and see if there is specific language, because I think if there isn't, it's an easy thing to add to make sure that the applicant is aware of it.
I appreciate that.
And the first annual report actually talks about some of the experience PDC's had monitoring annually financial pro formas for the rate of return.
I would actually like this agreement that we're voting on to reflect that provision of the code, so it's clear in the agreement, in addition to it being in the code, but it's clear in the agreement when you sign it and future applicants apply for and sign it, what the conditions of abatements are. So I don't know if I need to move to amend.
Barbara, is that, I'm assuming that the agreement says you're bound by all applicable law and code, but it seems to me that the agreement could be modified to specifically highlight that provision and have the applicant understand that they are bound by that agreement and the consequence of a breach. I think that's helpful.
And the other side of the coin, that's true that PDC is focused on asking for this information because in the past they had not been.
Mayor, I would view that as a friendly amendment so that it's a condition of our action today.
Thank you.
I think
so do you want us to add it to the ordinance?
Is that the document that is that the most appropriate place for it to be?
I think it's in the.
Is it in your regulatory agreement?
What they signed.
Well, the secretary is referring to adding wouldn't be in there right now.
I think that the agreement that I like the idea, and I think the agreement that you sign with the beneficiary should include that language, and I think it's important not only because it stares everybody, all parties in the face for the many years to come, but if anything changes on the council over the next however many years this is in force, that's the agreement that those are the terms and conditions that you agree to, regardless of what we do with other potential partners in the future.
So in that spirit, Barbara, my suggestion, because I think Commissioner Leonard is correct, that the ordinance we should just do a friendly amendment so the ordinance states that this is a condition. And the regulatory agreement, or whatever the term of art you use, which is the agreement with PDC and the applicant that authorizes the Todd abatement, specifically have this provision as well, so that that can be done through an amendment to the agreement or however you choose. But we would condition our approval on that being executed.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
The other,
I had a question for Ben. Does that then require us to vote on the amendment and then come back next week? It's an emergency ordinance.
It's an emergency ordinance. It can be amended and voted on today.
Okay.
The agreement itself is not before the council right now. The approval, this is an ordinance approving the exemption. So it would be added in as a condition of the approval of the exemption, and then the agency would have to go out and implement it. But I think the agency has received a strong signal from the council as to what this council's desires are. Adding it into the ordinance would enforce that.
The other, I look forward to Commissioner Fish, the work that you've done with PDC coming forward over the next couple of weeks. I think it's really important work. One message I just want to signal, since I don't get to interact with you necessarily very often, and also folks at PDC and in the Bureau, in the Office of Management and Finances, as part of our companion efforts to improve the overall reliability of the tax abatement program in terms of people monitoring and enforcing the terms and conditions. I also, as I have long held, believe that the foregone revenue should be booked or show up in our budget as an expenditure. And so I will be pursuing that, hopefully with the support of council, so that the public knows we're making an investment in a project and the foregone taxes are a contribution to a project, just like our tax increment resources are contribution to affordable housing projects, as our general fund, of which we give millions and millions of dollars for affordable housing. So I want that information daylighted and accessible to the public as part of our budget document. So just heads up.
Commissioner Adams, one thing the report does contain is not only a chapter on foregone revenue, but we've tried to break it out by jurisdiction so we can see how our partners are also bearing the load on these abatements. So I think that'll be interesting information for the council.
And what we've never had in our budget documents is a notation of that foregone revenue. And I voted against and for what I thought were worthy and unworthy tax abatement projects, but it needs to be daylighted so that we have ongoing accountability to the public.
Yes.
Is my impression that PDC will be the recipient of those annual reports and information? They will be our the group that you would like to see us report to on an annual basis.
Correct.
Is that correct? That's not
correct.
Changing.
Yes. Okay. Further questions? Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Is there anyone signed up to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify to this specific issue? Thank you. Thank you, folks. Please call a vote.
Mayor, I would first move the ordinance as amended with the condition that both the ordinance and the regulatory agreement between PDC and the applicant be amended to specifically require annual filings of the financial records for purpose of determining eligibility and compliance with all provisions of the Todd program.
Second.
Call a vote on the amendment.
Adams?
Aye.
Fish?
I want to thank Barbara for her good work from the Bureau of Planning and Comey Calavar and the team at PDC. I think when we get to the discussion next week, the council will see that a lot of hard work has gone into meeting the concerns raised by this council about how the abatement programs operate and how they are monitored. And I think in turn we will be moving forward to restore public confidence in this important tool that we use to build housing that meets the needs of some of our lowest income citizens. Aye.
Leonard.
When I first got on the council in 2002, the second council meeting I came to, I asked that an abatement for a project be pulled from the consent calendar. And it was not received warmly when I did that. So from that to this, and hearing Commissioner Fish talk the way he is today in terms of actually analyzing the whole program is really refreshing and much appreciated by me, as I'm sure Commissioner Saltzman feels as well, having been present for those same discussions as I was. The change in approach is excellent public policy and very much appreciated by me and the public. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I think this is a great project, and I want to thank Wayne Armstrong and Roland Stafford for making this happen. I mean, this is affordable housing, rental housing where it's needed. It will come with services, or at least some of the units that LifeWorks will be helping to support, and that's so crucial to making people successful, is having the services as well as the housing. And it's a very, notwithstanding its name, Shaver Green, it's also a very green project. Shooting for LEED Silver, and I believe the OSD Green Investment Fund also made an investment in this project, too, because of its pioneering green attributes. So this is a great project, and I'm very pleased to support it. I was also very pleased to have participated in a very hot day last spring or summer too, at the groundbreaking of Shaver Green. So pleased to vote aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please call the vote on the emergency.
Adams.
Thank you, Commissioner Nick Fish, for bringing this forward to us in a much improved manner, and Mayor Tom Potter in a much improved manner over previous projects. Thank you for doing the good technical work on it, and thanks to our partners for willing to be so transparent in you're part of this partnership. I look forward to the additional policy discussions before us, and I have voted against tax exemptions when I thought they were not in the best interest of the public, and I vote for this one because I think it is. Aye.
Fish.
Well, Mr. Armstrong, I want to thank you for having the persistence to pull this project together and move forward with it. As everyone knows, we're experiencing very tough times. And about a week ago, I was at the opening of Esperanza Court, which is a project of Catholic Charities and their housing, nonprofit housing arm. And it's a beautiful development in Southeast. Yesterday, I was at the Jeffrey opening, which is on the backside of the Art Museum, which is also a tremendous addition to our low-income affordable housing inventory. And Shaver Green will soon take its place. What I think you are telling us during tough times is that we still here in Portland, Oregon, when we work together, can achieve great things. And the 85 units that will be added to our inventory of low-income housing, the multi-year affordability program that's in place, the PSHs we're adding, and the other dividends, including what Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, the green components, really make this a model. And I can tell you, as our housing commissioner, when folks like you keep lifting the bar, it makes it easier to hold other nonprofit developers and for-profit developers to the same standards. So I'm very pleased to vote aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Potter.
I want to thank the Planning Bureau, Portland Development Commission, and you, Mr. Armstrong, for proposing such a great development for our community, and I think it will serve the needs of many of our poorest communities. So thank you. I vote aye. Thank you. Please read item 1430.
Authorized settlement agreement with Rocky Balada regarding disability benefit and employment claims.
Thank you for being here this morning, folks.
Good morning, Mayor Potter and City Council members. I'm Linda Jefferson, the Director of the Bureau of Fire and Police Disability and Retirement, and I'm here this morning to request your authorization for the settlement of the Rocky Balada claims for disability and employment benefits.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Harper, Deputy City Attorney with the City Attorney's Office here at the City of Portland.
I would like to say before I take any questions that you may have that in considering what action would be appropriate moving forward on this particular case, which was a very unique situation, in that it was incurred under the prior form of review, which was by the Board of Trustees. Unfortunately, the issue was never resolved before the charter reform, and so the review or appeals process is now before administrative law judges, and so the process is very different than it was historically. So there were a number of considerations with regard to this case, but I do want you to know that I think that this is a very good resolution for both the city and for FPDR. I would let you know that the exposure, had we gone to hearing and not prevailed, would have been very significant. We have determined that our disability costs would have exceeded $500,000. If we were directed to approve the claim under the FPDR system, we would be responsible for any medical costs that were incurred prior to that time and any going forward. We would also be responsible for any post-retirement medical benefits once this individual did retire, which would be a disability retirement rather than a service retirement. There would be the cost, the court costs associated with litigating the claim, and it was estimated that the trial or the hearing would last at least 3 weeks because there were numerous witnesses that would be called to testify. There would be the cost of expert witnesses. There would be, of course, attorney fees. And so when we looked at what the cost and benefit would be, and knowing that you never go into a hearing feeling confident or 100% confident that you'll prevail, we really felt that this was a good resolution at this time. So with that, I would ask if Stephanie has anything to add, or we can open up for questions.
And I just had one thing to add, just to clarify. So the recommended settlement, there are two parts that are before you. One is that there's a payment that comes from the Portland Police Bureau that resolves any and all employment-related issues. And
what's that amount?
That's a $500 amount. Mr. Bellotta is then leaves city employment by retirement. He agrees never to work at the city in any capacity, and completely waives and resolves any and all potential employment issues, including issues that might be associated with the city return to work program. And then the other amount that comes before you for your approval is the $92,300 that would come from FPDNR. Part of the charter reform that occurred in November 2006, with respect to FPDNR, really one key component was to professionalize the facilitation and administration of the disability claims process under the FPDNR system, to remove the Board of Trustees from that decision-making process with respect to the individual claims, and grants the administrator the authority to make decisions about disability claims, and then provide the City Council the authority to actually approve settlements that are recommended by the administrator. I just wanted to...
But doesn't the board still have the authority to hear claims of disability?
No, the claims of disability go before a hearings officer. The FPDNR Board of Trustees has contracted, and by charter is required to contract with a hearings officer to handle the disability hearing process. So individual disability claims do not go before the full Board of Trustees.
So why did not this claim go to a hearings officer?
This claim is scheduled to go to a hearings officer. Now, currently, that's the current status. The attorney that was hired by FPDNR, I think a couple of years ago, outside counsel, was to take this case to hearing, and it's actually they had two pre-hearing conferences on the case, and we're in the process of getting it scheduled for hearing. The hearing initially in this case, there was a hearing requested by Mr. Bellotta, and that was under the old FPDNR system. That would have occurred before the old Board of Trustees back in 2000, I guess.
So if I could ask, just so I understand the process, somebody's injured, a firefighter, a police officer is injured under the current system, and they file a claim for disability or medical payments or both. What happens to that claim?
I think Linda's...
Well, the claim is evaluated, and the determination
by staff.
The determination under my authority is made by the staff members. If the decision is adverse to the member, then they have the right to request a hearing before an administrative law judge, which we have contracted with Oregon Administrative Hearings Office to conduct those hearings.
So in this case, and I understand that it's a little messy because the claim originated under the old system and now we're adjudicating it under the new, but does it make any difference in terms of this case? Could you make a judgment about the claim still?
Well, I did.
And you denied it.
Not there was not a formal denial issued, but I did not approve the claim.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is in that a decision had not been formally made under the old board process. The claim has remained in a pendent status for the past 9 years.
How does that happen?
What status? I'm sorry. What was the word?
Pending.
It was pending a hearing. Okay.
So how does a claim remain pending for 9 years?
I could not answer that for you. It's fairly clear in the notes that I've reviewed that there were attempts by FPDR to reschedule a hearing. It had originally been convened in 2000, and the hearing was in executive session. The member had an opposition to that and asked for a postponement to look into the legality of the hearing not be held in an open forum. And then it appears that FPDR over the years tried to pursue resetting the hearing, but was not able to come to any agreement with the member through his representative. It's not clear what authority the Board of Trustees had during that period to force the issue, if you will, or maybe dismiss it for it not going forward sooner. So that's just not clear.
So in that time period, that 9-year time period, I'm assuming that the claimant was not receiving any salary from the police bureau.
That's correct. In fact, in 2000, Mr. Bellotta filed a non-service benefit claim with FPDR, and that claim was approved.
So he is receiving?
He did receive benefits through, I believe it was July or August 2006. And at that time, FPDR had medical information through an independent evaluation that he was able to return to his regular work.
In 2006?
In 2006. So his benefits for non-service disability were terminated.
Was he ordered back to work?
That's not clear to me in the record.
It's not clear whether he was ordered back to work?
There, at the time, he was either close to or very close to being eligible to retire. And in that process, my memory is that FPDNR at the time requested that we sort of stay put until we can try to negotiate with Mr. Bellotta.
And so in 2006, he would have been eligible for how many years credit towards retirement? July of 2006 when he was dropped off the non-service.
Well, in 2006, he would not have been vested to begin a service retirement at that point, which is one of the issues.
It would not have been vested?
That we're hoping to resolve at this point. Because of him being on a non-service disability benefit, he didn't accrue at the same rate that he would have had it been a service-connected claim.
But it still would have given him some amount of credit. Do you remember what
it would have given? And I don't remember what that amount would have been at that point. But once it appears that once the non-service disability benefits were terminated, that's the earliest that I see that discussions began on some type of a settlement to resolve the issues.
Do you recall if he's eligible for retirement in July of 2006?
I don't recall if he was eligible at that time. It might have been, I'm going back in my memory banks, and it seems like it might have been maybe February of the next year that he would have been eligible, but I would have to go back and
But because and look he at that. Wasn't getting any more retirement credit, he couldn't retire in February.
Correct. Well, and it seems like he wasn't yet at the eight, he hadn't hit the 55 years, right? So we were just looking for years of service was what
then,
we were
Then the obvious question is if his doctor in July of 06 said he was recovered enough to return to work, why did he not return to
work? His doctor did not say he was recovered.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's an independent evaluation.
Independent evaluation. So his doctor said he wasn't. Your doctor said he was. Then you had a third party make a determination that he was.
As I understand it, there were actually four medical evaluations conducted. And and I don't know the details of all of those, but the bottom line is there was going to be a dispute in the medical evidence about as to whether or not Mr. Bellotta was could be cleared to return to work. His doctor saying he wasn't cleared,
and the
IME from the fund saying that he was.
But our IME, that's part of the charter, right?
That's correct.
And our IME, according to the charter, said he had recovered sufficiently to return to duty. Is that right?
That's my understanding, yes.
So I mean, is his position then that his doctor said he wasn't recovered and therefore wasn't returning?
Yes. He has two issues that are currently scheduled for hearing. The first is whether he should have received service-connected benefits as opposed to non-service benefits between 2000 and 2006. And the second issue is whether FPDNR appropriately terminated his non-service